Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today was a developer at Bethesda for over 20 years, and he did a number of things there. It is a mouthful. He was a narrative designer. He did writing, world building, combat balance, character systems, mini games, crafting, gameplay scripting. He was the co-lead designer on Skyrim and lead systems designer on Starfield. Plus, he was the lore master of the Elder Scrolls. He is the one and only Kurt Coleman. How you doing?
I'm doing great. That was quite an introduction.
Well, you seem to be a jack of all trades, and that seems to be underselling it greatly. It's like the only thing you didn't do was art, sound design, and music, maybe. Just looking
well,
at this.
Well, actually on Redguard, I actually did art. So
you did do art. Well, there you go.
Well, everyone did on that project because it was such a small team. Yeah, that's the one and only art credit I have on a game.
Yeah, so how did you actually end up becoming known as, like, the lore master?
I think I advocated for it. Yeah, I think it... that's a good question. I mean, we were obviously pretty small back when I was hired. It may have something to do with, right? I started working there at the end of Daggerfall.
Yep.
Worked there through the beginning of, well, through most of Redguard. Went away for, I don't remember how long, 3 years maybe, and then came back. So when I came back, I was, you know, I had a history there. I had, you know, been around. I was one of the people that had been there, you know, at least from a design point of view, the longest, at least from, you know, they were, I don't know that we had anybody else except for Todd on the design side that was still working there that had worked on Daggerfall. So maybe because of that, I mean, I was always, you know, very involved in the lore, and I don't know if it ever, I mean, it may have started as kind of an informal thing of like, let's ask Kurt. He knows, like, he's really familiar with this stuff, or maybe he wrote that. and then at some point it became, I think when it became sort of quasi-official was when Zoss was founded and they were working on another group of people, another team was working on an Elder Scrolls game. And so, you know, Todd wanted to have somebody in-house that could sort of field their questions or review their content for lore. And so it was very quasi-official, though. It was never, it was never an official title. It was just sort of,
you're the guy.
What I sort of took on.
But are you able to actually retain everything from the lore? Or people ask you a question? Yeah, so they'd ask you a question, you'd go away, find the information, and come back.
Yes, I'm sure there are many people, especially in the fans, that know the lore better than I do.
100%. Right? Like,
especially given, you know, we would go away from the Elder Scrolls for years and years at a time working on other projects. So I would, you know, I wasn't living and breathing it day in and day out when we weren't working on an Elder Scrolls game. And obviously also, even when working on a game, a lot of what you're doing isn't lore. It's just the nuts and bolts of making the game or, you know, system design or whatever. It doesn't have anything to do with the lore. So, yeah, I wasn't, like, living in the lore. I think there are probably people at other, you know, other studios or places that have IP where the lore master is probably maybe a full-time job. I don't know. It probably could have been or should have been, but we didn't have the staff for that. So, yeah, that. But you know, I relied on the van sites. You know, like
oh really?
UESP, the Imperial Library, because they would compile everything. And what we did have, we tried to have an internal lore site. I mean, we had one, but it, like many things like that, we didn't have anyone dedicated to maintaining it. So it was, you know, we'd work on it and we'd get it up to date. And then, you know, we wouldn't have time to work on it for years and it would sort of languish and new things wouldn't have been added or whatever. So, but the people on the fan sites, they were always keeping things up to date. So those were my initial go-to. Not because, I mean, it's right. If I'm looking up like a book, you look quizzical, but they had all the lore. Like it was taken from the games. It wasn't like they wrote it. But if I wanted to look at what did the various books say, well, they had them easily accessible. We may have had them somewhere, but it was easier to look it up on USP. Or if I wanted to get like a quick rundown of like, what did this quest in Daggerfall do? Well, we didn't have that at all. Like we didn't, I don't know that we had any information from like our records, the internal, like what I guess it was a wiki went back to Oblivion, but stuff from previous, we probably had the text of the books because we had them in the editor and we could put them in, but the data from the Morrowind quests or Daggerfall quests, we didn't have that anymore. I couldn't, it was not easy to pull that up. I didn't just have Morrowind installed on my computer and I could just pull up the editor and look at it. So it was much, and even if I could, that would have been a very cumbersome way to like figure out what went on in, say, a Morrowind quest, right? Like I could look on UESP, they would have it all like laid out.
It's good that you're able to elaborate on that, because I think there's this perception that you were just the Bible and that you retained everything, and everyone would come to you and you'd just know it straight off the bat.
To me, the actual more the role was, it wasn't, because anyone could do that, right? Anyone could look it up. You didn't need me to do that. It was more for new stuff. That's to me what I saw was, does this fit? Should we add this, or does this contradict something? That's a bit harder to come by, and it's much more of a judgment call, right? Like, if we're doing a new thing, should we do it? Does it fit with the vibe of Elder Scrolls? Does it maybe we wanted to not answer that question? Maybe we want to keep that open. That was also a lot of it was, we were avoid answering questions, or, you know, if there was, you know, lore that was like open that it could have been this, that, or the other thing, it was better not to answer that question until we had to. Like if we needed to answer that question because we were putting it in one of our games, then we would answer the question. But there's no reason just to write a book that answers that question unrelated to the game if you didn't have to, because you never know when you might need the, you know, room to maneuver when you want to make something in the future. And you're like, damn it, I wish we hadn't said that like 5 years ago. Because we would have liked to be able to do the other thing.
That makes sense. Because you studied history, right? At was it Michigan University and Duke University?
And then Michigan State was my undergrad. And then I got a master's degree at Duke. So, and at Duke was where I got a master's degree in history. So, That's what I kind of came out of Duke and went to work for Bethesda the first time.
But what made you decide to kind of go in that decision, like to pivot to game development?
The fact that when I finally figured out, like I was working on my PhD and I finally, so you maybe be a little late to figure this out, that I didn't really like doing research and I didn't really like teaching. That's pretty much what you do with a PhD in history, right? You do research and teach. So then I was kind of at a like, well, now what am I going to do? What else do I like to do? And I mean, back in the late 90s, it wasn't really like getting into games wasn't like a main career that people, at least I hadn't really thought of doing. I thought it was a hobby. Like a friend of mine from high school, we had made a couple of board games together. So, you know, and we were like doing that, but I didn't look on that as a career, at least until I was like, well, what do I want to do with my life? And I think I started looking at game jobs just as a like, I guess, yeah, that would be fun if you could get a job doing that. It didn't seem like a real thing that I, you know, somebody does that, but it, I, you know, not very many people. And could I get a job doing that? But yeah, then I did.
So did it turn out to be what you thought it would be when you first started working for Bethesda as a writer, so to speak?
I mean, we didn't have writers. I mean, I don't know, but that's still, as far as I know, doesn't have writers. Like we
it's like
were
narrative design.
We were called quest designers.
Yeah.
And for a long time, that was the only kind of designers there were. There were just quest designers and then world artists who built the levels. And I don't remember which project. I think it was maybe Fallout 3 where level design became an official like group
title.
Of people that sort of split off from world art. But up right up through my time when I left, it was still quest designers. We didn't have narrative designers separate from that. So the quest designers were the people that we did the writing, but we also did, I guess, what would be called mission design. And, you know, we wrote it, wrote the dialogue, came up with the stories and put it in the game and implemented it. The part that we didn't do was build the levels. Like we didn't put together the world that our stories were taking place in, but we did pretty much everything else to do with, like, if we're putting together a quest, we would get, you know, if this guy had to walk from here to there and then say something, that's what we would do.
So would you draw from your experience from teaching history?
I never really taught history, but from studying history, absolutely. That's a lot of, and obviously I enjoyed it. That's why I went into that field to begin with, is I enjoyed learning about it and reading about it. So, you know, world building in a lot of ways is building a, making up a history instead of uncovering it from the real world. You're making it up. But I always liked, you know, that was very useful to me, that my background, because lots of analogies that you can use from, you know, various ancient history, ancient cultures that you can put into like fantasy games.
Because you're a fan of Norse epics and Tolkien, right?
Tolkien, absolutely, yeah. Norse epics, I haven't, that's more tangential to working on Skyrim, I guess. But yeah, I don't know that I would say I'm a fan of Norse epics just because I haven't really delved into that too much. But
right. So what are some of the nuances, I suppose, from Tolkien lore that you'd try to interweave into some of the lore within Elder Scrolls?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say I would try to get lore from Tolkien, but I would, you look at what Tolkien, the world he made, I think that to me is sort of the example of world building. I mean, it's not my insight in any way, but just the fact that what you see in the books is essentially the tip of the iceberg. You know, you can tell the difference between when you read a book where everything that the author knows about the world is in the book and they didn't think any more about the world than they had to for what they were going to put on the page, versus the Tolkien way, which is, I think, common to many of the best books that involve world building, where he knows way more about the world than is in the book. And that was more or less because he wrote the Silmarillion first. And so he had all the world, but then he wrote the Lord of the Rings because he couldn't get the Silmarillion published. So he already had like this vast like backstory and history of his world when he was writing Lord of the Rings. But you feel that, right? When, you know, somebody just sort of starts singing about, you know, Beren and Luthien, they don't really explain who those people are, but it feels like they know, and you feel like the author knows. It's not, it doesn't feel like it's just made up on the spot at that, on that page when the author was writing it, because it wasn't. So I, like, to me, that is what I would always strive for in world building, is to know more about the world than we were going to tell the players. And I think a lot of that has to do with, that's useful for the designers as well. And maybe as much for the designers that are working on the world as it is for the players, because the designers also want to know, and it helps inform their writing and the stories that they're building if they know more about the world and the history of the world, right? Like, the more you know, the more you can make it feel real and feel grounded. The story you wrote isn't just this sort of superficial story that sits this sort of isolated. If you know more about the world, you can connect that story into the world, even in subtle ways.
So how do you pivot in terms of narrative then when you go to something like Fallout? Because Elder Scrolls is kind of medieval.
Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com. That's PolicyGenius.com.
Language, I guess you could say, and Fallout's a bit more modern. And so the approach to how you write stuff is going to be completely different.
Yeah, absolutely. That was always, I think most people in the studio really liked that we would pivot.
Alternate, yeah.
I mean, obviously when I first started at Bethesda, we didn't have Fallout. So we were just, when I first started, I expected we were just going to make Elder Scrolls games. And then, you know, we got the Fallout IP. So that was a bit of a surprise pivot to everyone, I think. But it turned out, you know, in that sort of sequence of Oblivion, Fallout 3, Skyrim, Fallout 4.
Yeah.
That really worked out well for the designers because it kept things fresh. Like, as much as everyone loves, that worked on it, loves the Elder Scrolls, you do get a bit tired of it after working on it for 5 years or whatever. And so knowing that there's this real change of pace, post-apocalyptic, modern, totally different tone, like kind of can be more kooky. It's got the weird black humor in it. It was a challenge, I'll say, when you first transition from writing an Elder Scrolls dialogue and quest to a Fallout. And then you go, like, every time we did that, there was a transition period where, you know, the designers would write something and, you know, Emil or whoever, we would have to like really like, okay, we gotta get back in the groove of this new, we gotta get back in the Elder Scrolls groove, or we gotta get back in the Fallout groove, because people would still be in the, at least some people
in
may
the previous
have,
one. Yeah.
Depending on, you know, some people are more or less comfortable with one or the other. And so some people would be find it easier to transition because it was the thing they were more comfortable writing. But then they would have maybe a harder time transitioning back to the other one.
How long was the transition?
You mean as far as getting people like
in the groove? Yeah.
In the groove? It would be a few months maybe at most. I mean, it's not like you're throwing away everything you're doing. It's just, you might write a bunch of dialogue and then you're like, I got to edit some of that because I'm still writing it in the Elder Scrolls tone. Or you start writing some Elder Scrolls stuff and people are like cursing or they're talking in sort of modern ways. And it's like, okay, guys, we got to, you know, go over that again and do another pass on your dialogue. And we would have, you know, we would have peer reviews and meetings where we would look at dialogue and say, okay, this is working. This is the tone for the game now. And it wouldn't really take, if you think about how long a project is, it's 4 years.
It's a long time. Yeah.
So a few months of transition isn't that really big a deal. And it's just kind of the nature of getting your head back in that space and sort of re-familiarizing yourself with, you know, one thing people would do a lot is they would go back and play the previous game to sort of immerse themselves in the dialogue and the stories and the world. You know, so when we started Skyrim, people would go back and play Oblivion just to get out of Fallout, back to Elder Scrolls.
Would you keep like a thesaurus or an encyclopedia by your desk just as a frame of reference for like a synonym or something? If a particular word is sticking out that it's like, this doesn't really fit here, need to change it to something else.
I mean,
it's essentially the same word.
Yeah, I used a thesaurus quite a bit. I don't know, like, I suppose other people that write do that. We would have, actually it was both Elder Scrolls and Fallout, where we would have, you know, on our development website, you know, here are words that you should use, you know, slang terms, things that aren't necessarily familiar words, but words that we wanted to, that fit in the world. I think there were some words that we used in Skyrim that was sort of that the Nord slang, and there was, I'm sure, some in Fallout too. But I think it's not so much the exact words, it's more the tone, which is harder to quantify. Like, you can't just spell it out like in three bullet points to say, this is how you write for Fallout, this is how you write for Elder Scrolls. It's much more of, you have to kind of immerse yourself in it and kind of get it. There are some things you say, like, we didn't use profanity in Elder Scrolls, right? I don't think that was, you know, that was out of tone. And then there are particular things in Elder Scrolls where, like, the Khajiit have a way of talking. That could get kind of difficult sometimes. Write dialogue that especially with voice acting, that an actor could say plausibly.
Did you ever get to oversee any of the voice acting? Because obviously you can write something and it might sound good in your head, but then when you hear someone else say it, and depending on their accent and their tone and everything, it can give a completely different context or meaning to the words.
Yeah, actually, in general, I'm trying to remember, because it changed a bit on every project. Oblivion was, I guess, the first. I don't know. I didn't work on Morrowind, so I don't remember what kind of VO there was, if any, on Morrowind. But on Oblivion was the first, our first fully voiced game, I think. Pretty sure that's true. So the designers, we actually would go to Oblivion was done with like local Washington, D.C. area voice talent. So we were actually able to just literally go to the studio during the recording sessions and sit in there and, you know, talk directly to them in the studio. And we generally kept doing that, you know, when we were recording, even when we started doing it mostly in L.A., we would travel to L.A. in general, but we would do, you know, at that point it was a phone call. But we would get on the phone with the studio so we could hear what was going on and we could, you know, give feedback to the actors or the voice director that was there at the studio in L.A. And so generally the designers whose content this was, like the people who wrote the thing that was being recorded, they would sit in on the sessions when they were being recorded. So that was super helpful, obviously. Another thing we did, again, it changed over the course of each project. I think in later projects, we started doing what we called rolling dialogue, where we would start to record parts of the game as early as possible. And usually that was things that we knew were less likely to have to change. And I mean, even when we did that, we knew that there was going to be a certain percentage of what we recorded that was going to have to get thrown away. That was just the nature of it. Obviously, at some point you're locked in, you know, during the last final voice sessions, that's it. But usually we would have multiple sessions with the actors. So we would know, like, in the early one, but that was really helpful because, well, as soon as you hear, you know, people saying the lines, as opposed to, you know, robo voice back then was very primitive. But one of the things, especially before we did rolling dialogue on projects, the designers would record the dialogue themselves. Like, you would sit at your desk and just record the lines. I don't know if we did all of them, but like when we were going to do a play test or something. So that was both useful for people playtesting it to have actual audio. Now, we're not obviously voice actors, but even anything recorded was better than just reading subtitles. And for me, at least, I found that I was constantly rewriting things while I was doing that. I would record something or try to say it. I'd be like, oh, I mean, it would immediately, as soon as you try to say it out loud, you immediately realize if it's not working. Like, oh, that doesn't sound, no one would say that out loud. You could write that, but it doesn't sound like that, right?
That's what Harrison Ford said to George Lucas about Star Wars, you know?
So, yeah.
Yeah, it rings now, true.
I'm sure there are people that, you know, better writers than I am that can do that without having to say it out loud. They can hear it in their head. But for me, that was a very useful process. Especially, I don't know, in games, I know people will be like, you know, game writing is bad in general. I think a lot of that, to me, isn't the, well, there's some of is that we're jack of all trades, especially at Bethesda, right? We were not pure writers. We had to do everything. We had to be good enough writers. We also had to be good scripters and make the missions and come up with the stories. And because of that, we couldn't focus all of our time just on writing and rewriting. So we had a relatively limited amount of time to write something and then iterate on it. We obviously did do that, but and there's quantities of dialogue, like especially when you're doing like an open world game with multiple paths or the player can ask questions, you're writing an enormous number of lines of dialogue. So that's a lot to get through, iterate on. It's not the same as a, you know, if you look at like a script. Well, each character is only saying one thing at one time, and you know exactly the sequence that's going to happen. And at least when you're writing the script, we don't know even the sequence of things. A lot of the dialogue could be out of order, or you don't know the context of when this person is going to say it because the player could be asking a question. There could be branching branches in the quest that could cause the player to come to something earlier or later, and different things happened leading up to it. So yeah, not making excuses, but there is, at least in our studio, we were wearing a lot of hats. So, and Bethesda always was, at least maybe up through, at least through those first four games, we were relatively small compared to the studios that we might've been, our games were competing with. So we were sort of making those games effectively on a shoestring.
But there were so many overlapping roles, right? I know some of the former Bethesda devs have said that, like with Starfield, because it had ballooned in size, that was no longer possible to some degree because you were almost siloed.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That was one of the things I liked about the games, and I think it has a lot of advantages that we had the quest designer who was handling all of the stuff. I think that really helps the story and the dialogue be very integrated into the gameplay. It's not, we weren't writing it in isolation. We knew because we were putting it in the game exactly what was going to be happening when these characters were saying this, what was leading up to it. If we're writing, you know, dialogue for, you know, someone's going through a dungeon with you or something and we're writing the dialogue, we know exactly what's going on because we're putting it together. And we're playtesting it and seeing it in context all the time. So, and because of that also, we can revise things when we see it in context. We didn't have to tell someone, hey, this line doesn't work here, and have them change it. We could just change it because it was also our dialogue.
Well, that would add a lot more time as well, having to do it that way where you go in and be like, hey, can you change this?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, my current studio, I am for the first time working with, you know, narrative writers. Those people are really good at their jobs. They're almost certainly better writers than, they're certainly better writers than I am. They're maybe better writers than anybody at Bethesda was when I worked there. But it does, I can also see, because I have seen it both ways, it adds to the overhead of there's the back and forth. So, you know, it may be that I think things may have even somewhat moved on at Bethesda. I'm not sure. We were definitely getting more specialized as the studio got bigger. For instance, right, I was the first lead system designer that we ever had on Starfield. You'd think, didn't anyone do system design before Starfield? Well, of course, right? We were obviously doing tons of system design, but it wasn't an official title. We were, you know, the people that were doing system design were also in charge of quests and, you know, everything else. We were doing maybe less quests than some people that were only doing quests. You know, the people that were doing system design, that was worked into their schedule, but we were still doing many things, which was, you know, it had benefits for gameplay. It was also a lot of fun because a lot of people don't want to be siloed. They, you know, lots of designers have many skills. They can write
get bored as
and
well,
they can,
wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it was, I always liked it. Because I didn't really want to only do one thing.
Yeah, well, I would think
a lot of people
that
like that.
Yeah. So when you say systems design, though, what does that actually mean when you call yourself a systems designer?
The shorthand, yeah, I get that question a lot because is the rules of the game. How does the game work? That's system design. How much, when I swing this sword, how much damage does it do? How long does it?
It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
Take to get a new level or to gain a skill point, or how does alchemy work? How do the mini games work, right? Like, who puts that all together? Combat balance, how strong are the monsters? How long does it take to kill them? How many hits? How many different kinds of, you know, if swords you have, like as you level up, how do things get stronger around you? All that is system design.
So you're working in conjunction with a lot of the quest designers and level designers in general, I suppose.
I mean, if you're talking about when I was purely a system designer, like on Starfield.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a bit of a new experience, but yes. And there's definitely overlap as far as because there are some things that are, in some sense, most of the game is systems. Except for the writing, but for instance, the system of in Starfield of placing locations on the planets, like when you would land on a spot on the planet and you'd see in the distance there's this location and that location, and in Starfield, all the exploration of the planet, I don't know if you played Starfield, but you run around and you scan creatures and you find the minerals and you workshop in Fallout 4 and Outpost in Starfield, that's system design. As a system designer, I could say pretty much anything but the story is system design. That's not literally true, but...
It sounds like it still covers a broad amount of areas that in terms of things that you touch, right? So
yeah, it's very broad.
Yeah, which is good because I'd imagine even with that role, even though it's siloed, so to speak, there's still enough there to prevent you from getting bored and to feel challenged. Yeah,
definitely. I mean, one of the things I missed on Starfield was I wasn't doing the narrative design part of it really at all. But that... there was plenty of system. I mean, it's not like as the lead, I wasn't doing it all, but at least I had a overview of it. Especially on Starfield, we were creating a lot of new systems. That was, I think, one of the issues with that game taking so long is if you look at the difference between Oblivion 2 Fallout 3, Fallout 3 to Skyrim. Like, what's the same and what's different in from one game to the next? I might say 25%, 20% new as far as game systems, maybe for each of those games. From, I guess, I don't know if 76, really, it's more like Fallout 4 to Starfield, because 76 was a multiplayer game, so that was a lot of different, like, I don't know that, I think Starfield built off of Fallout 4 largely, but the difference between Fallout 4 and Starfield was huge, comparatively, like, space, spaceships, modular spaceships, planets, and not just planets, but like vast, procedurally put together landscape planets. I'm sure I'm forgetting like 10 things, but just, you know, that's just off the top of my head.
The
completely brand new, like, things that we had to build from scratch. Like, some of those are whole genres, right? Like a spaceship combat game. That's a genre that we just sort of added on to our game.
Right? Yeah, true.
And, you know, it's difficult to just start from scratch and add that into your game, and that we're just going to be, you know, as good as a game where that's the only thing that the game is about. So,
right.
It took a long time.
Yeah. So I imagine then with Starfield 2, whenever that happens, there will already be the template there that can be built off it. Because with Starfield, you're essentially doing everything from scratch. Even from Skyrim to from Oblivion to Skyrim and Fallout 3 to 4, there was already a template there that you could build off.
I mean, we did build. There was quite a bit. You know, we already, Fallout 4, Starfield wasn't built entirely from scratch. Of course, if you look at the creation kit from Fallout 4 and you look at the creation kit from Starfield, they look very similar. Starfield has a bunch of new stuff in it that didn't exist in Fallout 4 because of all the new systems. That's what I'm talking about. There was many more new things, but we still, you know, guns, armor, the enemies, combat, like a lot of that, you know,
was carried over.
Having AI, the quest systems that we use to build quests, procedural quest stuff, a lot of that, obviously we changed it and modified it, maybe upgraded it, but a lot of that is the same. I mean, that was one of the advantages that Bethesda always had, was we weren't starting from scratch every time. We were building on top of. So we were, you know, the designers, artists. Well, I can't speak for the artists because I think they changed their workflow or pipeline maybe more often in a large way than designers did. But for designers, the carryover was usually it was a pretty easy transition from the point of view of the tools. Like, you know, we had the same scripting system starting with Skyrim right up through Starfield. That was one of the problems with 76, was multiplayer game, many of the things that we had done couldn't work in a multiplayer server-based game. Like, we had a completely different... So we lost a lot of institutional knowledge that we relied on previously from going from one game to another. 76, maybe in a lot of ways from a design point of view, was more different than going from Fallout 4 to Starfield. As far as the work that how the designers worked and how we made content, it was a huge upheaval of pretty much like everything that we knew how to do. We had to relearn it.
Is Elder Scrolls 6 in a way going to be bittersweet for you, because obviously you're not involved in it, but by the same token, you kind of get to go in like I would as a fan and not really knowing anything, which would be a joy, I would think.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know yet. right? Because I don't know. There's the trepidation of like, I don't want to, this isn't named at anybody, but just like when you've worked on something for a long time and then you're not working on it and someone else is doing it, you have that. And I had the same feeling about ESO when they started working on it, is like, this was entirely my thing, not literally me, but you know,
yeah,
it was all contained. We, the team, it was our thing. And then, well, when ESO, they were doing their own thing. They have their own team. They have their own ideas. We're not in charge of it anymore. It's now out there, and they're going to make something different than what we would have done. That doesn't mean it's bad, obviously. So Elder Scrolls 6, same deal. They're making something different than what I would have done. And so I don't know how I'm going to feel about that when I see it, right? Like, it's, so yeah, it is definitely going to be a new experience for me.
Were you involved at all in any of the lore and any pre-production, or was no?
No, not for Elder Scrolls 6.
Wow. Okay. So don't even know who's taking care of all that stuff. I mean, obviously it's still years away.
I mean, so. I do know because I know people, but I can't talk about
it.
Obviously.
You can't talk about it.
And I know who's working on it just because I'm, you know, still friends with people that work there, but I don't know anything about what the game is. They're not allowed to tell me that. And it's probably for the best that I don't know, right? Like,
yeah,
even if I was allowed to know, there's nothing that I can do about it, right? I can't. If I like it or dislike it, it's out of my hands.
How did you feel about the Fallout show then, in terms of the writing? Could you go in and just enjoy it, or were you picking it apart?
I guess I'm not as invested in Fallout. That I was never like the lead on it, and it, you know, it wasn't my thing as much. I worked on it, but I wasn't as, you know, I was always an Elder Scrolls person. So I have a little bit more detachment from it probably than, you know, say Emil or somebody like that. I thought it was good. I think they did a fantastic job of translating the game into a TV show. It was extremely faithful. In the best way. Like, you see some things that are faithful that are too faithful, like from a book or something to a movie where they, you know, you can go both ways, right? You can completely forget about the book, and then you're like, why did you even base it off that if you didn't want to do any of it? And then you see it the other way where they're too faithful. They like don't want to deviate at all from the book. And obviously a book and a visual medium have to be two different things. I had as a super fan of the Lord of the Rings, I had originally a same feeling about like the Lord of the Rings movies. I'm like, they're changing too much. I have, at least especially for Fellowship of the Ring, I love that movie now. And I'm like, I've come to terms with, you know, those are good changes. A lot of the changes they had to make. And if you were maybe going to make it, you know, an HBO series, you could have remained more faithful to the books. But if you want to make even a 3-hour movie or whatever the director's cut is, they can just barely get that story told in 3 hours. So,
well, I think that's why they had the extended editions as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm talking about. I consider the extended editions.
Oh, they're the real ones, dude.
The real ones. I mean, if you go back, I don't know if you have, the movie version of it is so truncated in so many ways. All those movies, I find it essentially unwatchable. I don't know.
It's been a while since I've watched the extended editions.
Yeah, if you watched the original theatrical release, you would probably be stunned at how much was left out of what you think was the movie. At least that's my experience. Like, I've watched the DVD version of it now so much that I can hardly remember the difference. But I remember when I first watched it, I think maybe I went back and watched the theatrical version, or maybe they showed it in a theater or something. And I was like, whoa, that wasn't in that. That's the movie that should have been released. But I guess at that point, he didn't have the pull to get a three and a half hour movie.
Well, it was so risky at the time, right? It was unheard of, filming three movies at the same time, like over a period of 200 days or whatever it was. It was unprecedented.
A fantasy movie, I think, was a huge risk. No one, no one had really made a successful fantasy movie in quite a while. Yep. Not at the budget that they had.
Yeah, so they did a good job. So what's your relationship been like with Todd over the years? Because obviously you knew him before he became the big celebrity, obviously, and now he's managing all these different projects. And
Yeah. I mean, back then, you know, it was very different. Obviously, when I worked, the first time I worked at Bethesda, it was a very small group. And I think at that point I was a designer. I don't know if we had very little structure of the projects. I think he was the lead of the projects, but I think he was considered a designer then. And he's a good designer. So I knew him, you know, we would, you know, go to people's apartments to hang out or whatever. And at the beginning, you know, in the early days, I'm not sure when this went through, but, you know, we're all in one floor of the building. Everyone would sort of eat together in the cafeteria. Todd would eat lunch with the various people. And you just walk into his office and ask him a question, or, you know, when, like, on Oblivion or Skyrim, working on the main quest. I think both those cases was a lot of, like, just back and forth for, you know, weeks or whatever, working on the story. Like, I would work on it, bounce ideas off of Todd, go back, revise, work on it again. I don't know how that went. Skyrim is my last experience with doing that, so I don't know how that went on the subsequent projects. But, you know, over time, Todd became, you know, at the time, like Oblivion, Fallout 3, Skyrim even, you know, that's pretty much the only thing he's doing. He's
the, yeah, just the one project.
He's the creative lead of that project. That's his job. At some point, he became also sort of in charge of multiple studios. And also then there would be all the people that wanted his time for this, that, and the other, right? So that over time, he became, you know, less available.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Accessible for people that were not just at the very, like, leads of a project. And I think even for, in some cases, for the leads, he was not as accessible as they would want, just because he became busier and busier. And so, you know, that's where you get more layers of management, maybe inevitable. I don't know. I became sort of less and less enchanted with that aspect of it as the studio got bigger and bigger. Like when we were making Starfield with four studios, a very different experience than making Skyrim or Oblivion. When you're working directly, you know, Skyrim was maybe 120 people all together in one building.
I mean, I've heard that once you get over like a 140 person threshold, it's very hard to kind of keep special elements of a team there.
Yeah, and I suppose even if we were in the same building, it's hard for you to know all the 400 people. But when you're in different locations, even much harder. That was a big that first cropped up on 76, where we had, I think, fundamentally two studios working, and maybe some people in Montreal as well. And then the beginning of Starfield, I think it got worse. I actually think the pandemic in some ways helped that.
Really?
In a weird way. Well, we all had to get used to working completely remotely. But what that eliminated, at least for a while, not eliminated, but it really helped, was there was the Rockville studio. These are people that have worked together for a long time. We all knew each other. We all, like, were working in the same building. There was the Austin studio. They had maybe less history together, but they were all working together. So there was very much, there was the people that would talk together in this studio and the people that would talk together in that studio, but they weren't, right? We were only interacting in meetings. So that there was a lot of a, you know, I don't know if us and them is the right word, but the different studios were kind of isolated from each other, because we didn't really know how to do that. Wasn't like someone magically was like, this is how you do two studio development. We didn't really change our processes. And then when you get to four, but when we went to the pandemic, now it's not like previously everyone would be sitting in a meeting room, say in Rockville, and there'd be two or three people on the screen trying to talk to, trying to participate in the meeting. And I've been on the other end of that. Pretty much the people on the screen are not participating in the meeting unless they're being directly addressed. Right. I turn to someone next to me and I'm talking. We weren't set up with like the perfect mics, and these were, you've got the speakerphone sitting in the middle of the table, right? Like, but when we all went to remote, I actually think it helped, because now it didn't make any difference. I didn't know where anyone was. Everyone was on screen. None of us were sitting in a conference room together. So it made everybody on an equal footing. And instead of me just like leaning around the corner and having a conversation with the person in the desk next to me or across the hall, we're doing everything on Slack. So I can talk to people in Austin or Dallas or Montreal on Slack just as easily as I can talk to the people that I work with in Rockville. So it really leveled the playing field there. I don't know how that, I think maybe I think they, they're doing more of a return to office now. That's what I hear. And I would suspect that may have kind of crept back.
Yep. It's a weird one. I have a couple of questions from my followers. Maybe you can answer them. Maybe you cannot. Maybe you'll be like, no comment. We will see. So the first question here is from Vinny Yol Olmsted 8018. What would your ideal sequel to Redguard be?
Well, we originally, the people that were making it, like especially Michael and I, wanted to do, we had started to like sketch out ideas for The Eye of Argonia, which was going to be, not surprisingly, a very Indiana Jones-ish, Argonia being like this jungly marsh. It's Black Marsh is the other name for it. You've got the lizard people, the Argonians, you've got jungle temples, and that would have been, that was absolutely what we had in mind. Cyrus and Tobias, continuing adventures, but sadly, never to be.
Did you actually pitch it or anything? Or was this just an idea?
Well, I left before Redguard shipped. So I was in a position to pitch anything after Redguard finished. But I think Redguard didn't. So this is just something we were talking about while we were making the game. Like, hey, the next game we should do is this. Redguard did not in any way do well enough commercially to make the studio want to do a sequel to it. I think it was pretty much of a commercial flop, even though it was well rated. The reviews were good, but for whatever reason, it didn't sell very well.
Okay. Next question here from LukeKickLine 9513. What to him is the grounding element of Elder Scrolls stories, as in what commonality makes a main quest of the Elder Scrolls feel consistent within the franchise?
That is an interesting question.
That's a doozy.
Yeah, I don't know. There are some things that we have done repeatedly. Whether that is what you should always do for an Elder Scrolls game or not, I don't know. I mean, the sort of chosen one thing is we fell back on that more than once. I'll back up and be more vague. I think essentially, in my opinion, the unknown person. We aren't telling you who you are. You're not Geralt. You're whoever you are. That to me is the advantage of the unknown prisoner. We're letting you, it's a as an RPG, we're letting you create your own character. So that's sort of fundamental to that kind of RPG is you get to, you know, make your own name. But even, you know, you look at Fallout, that's very different. You do have a backstory. You are this guy who had a wife and you ran, you know exactly what your backstory is in those games. Whereas in, you know, Oblivion or Skyrim, how did you get it to be in jail? How did you get to be in that cart? You don't really know. And you get to tell your own story. So that, in a lot of ways, makes the writing more difficult. I don't know that people appreciate that. Because you can't write to the character that the player is, because we don't know who you are.
Yeah, that's true.
So your responses and the people's reaction to you can't be based on who you are, because we don't want to lock you into who you are. So that I don't, until you've tried it, I think people would not appreciate how that really does make it difficult to, especially in writing, when we start trying to do player responses, you can't really put a tone on it because we don't know who you are. You are who you want to be. So we have to make sure to preserve that. So I think that to me is essential for the Elder Scrolls, at least what we have, you know, what's been done in the game so far. I would, and that to me always was important, to let you be who you wanted to be and not try to force you into who we wanted you to be. So if you're doing heroic things, it's because you've chosen to do those. You're doing a heroic quest, but you could also do the Dark Brotherhood and do unheroic things. You could do unheroic things while you're doing the main quest also. Like, you know, we can't, because it's an open world game, and, you know, the BGS games were all about sort of maximum freedom for the player. We would try not to constrain you as much as possible.
Yeah, that's a good answer.
So,
okay. Yeah. Okay, final question. This is from Nexturant _ Zelium 4045. These names, man. Does he wish sometimes that after Morrowind, the Elder Scrolls continued to feature more of the weird fiction lore? And does he like that psychedelic approach to world building? Or does he prefer the more tame European fantasy like in Oblivion?
Oh, I definitely... So I didn't. I came back during the end of pre-production on Oblivion. So I was not involved. I wasn't the lead on Oblivion. So I wasn't involved in the initial... The world building for Oblivion was pretty much done when I started on it. And I'm not like mad about it or anything, but when I came in there and realized what they were doing, I was like, yeah, this is not, like, if you look at the Pocket Guide to the Empire and what, like, Michael and I don't know who wrote the Cyrodiil chapter, but I feel like it was written in there. That was a much weirder place than what you see in Oblivion. There are reasons for that. I think Todd in particular gravitates not towards the weird stuff. I do. Like, Morrowind, I was originally, way back when we were working on Morrowind before Redguard, I was the design lead, and then, you know, but so Michael and I had done a lot of like brainstorming on that, and we were, you know, obviously it's got the Dune vibes and the Dark Crystal vibes. I love that stuff. I would definitely put more in it if I could have. Now, there is another aspect to it, which is it, if you're in charge of spending all this money and you want your studio to continue to exist and pay salaries for people, you have to make a successful commercial product. So whether what I had in mind for Cyrodiil would have made for a more successful game than Oblivion, I can't say. I suspect that in that sense, that was the right decision. When you got Lord of the Rings, wildly popular. I think the movies may have still been coming out when Oblivion came out. I know some of them were out already. But I do like the weird stuff, but I like it mixed. That was another thing that Morn is probably about, you know, the maximum weird I would want to go with the game. You could go less weird. Skyrim isn't all that weird, but it's maybe a little, it's got some maybe more dark corners than Oblivion had. So obviously I didn't have carte blanche to do whatever I wanted in Skyrim either, even though I was one of the leads. It's a team effort, and you know, a group of people have to agree on things, even when you're a lead. So
do you think there's any chance of them going back to that at any point, or do you think we're too far past that to kind of go back to the Morrowind psychedelic days?
I personally don't,
because there's too much riding on it, I would think.
I think that it's probably that it's, especially now, it's just, yeah, it's, you've got Microsoft, it's got to be one of their big things. I would be skeptical that they could do a game in like Elsweyr or Black Marsh because of that, because those inherently, the main population are lizard people or cat people, right? Mm. Like that becomes much weirder than a place that's human population. So I think it's harder to do.
Yeah, I mean,
there ever is a Tez 7, I'm very curious as to where they would put it.
Well, I mean, there's been talks of them like remaking Morrowind because of the Oblivion remaster, but...
Well, a remaster is different than setting a Tez 7 in Morrowind, right?
That's yeah.
Very different, yeah.
But I imagine some of it would have to do with Todd as well. I mean, if Todd's still... I mean, I would...
I don't think it would be some of it. I think it would be all of it.
Yeah. But like I'd mentioned, he probably will have retired after Fallout 5 if we're just going off time.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, that's so far in the future. I can't even see. I don't know who would be making it. Like, would it even be BGS anymore? Like, yeah, that's too far in the future for me to even imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Kurt, this is a good place to wrap up. Thank you so much for sparing me your time. Thank you for everything you've done over the 20 years that you worked at Bethesda. And I hope to see what you're working on soon, I guess.
All right. Well, it's a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Cool. All right. That is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.
Wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.